number under 25,000. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is our Small World Radio production.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Indeed. Keep your dial set right here, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. 9 p.m. Wednesday evening. Time now for RPM, revolutions per minute.
Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, what's up, New York City? It's Amy Wilson. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI. We are a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 90,000 members nationwide. New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 7,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Once again, my name is Amy Wilson. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a member of North Brooklyn DSA. Tonight, we have a very special episode of Revolutions Per Minute. As you may have heard on a previous show, the Democratic Socialists of America recently launched a national anti-fascist working group to connect organizers all over the country who had been working independently on anti-fascist response in their communities. A week and a half ago, on July 11th, comrades from Suffolk County on Long Island, Portland, Oregon, Houston, Chicago, and Kansas City told their stories on a national kickoff call. For today's show, we're pleased to present excerpts from those stories alongside beautiful anti-fascist folk music and maybe even another artistic surprise. I hope this show will give you a deeper understanding of the many forms that anti-fascist organizing can take and how, when people all over this world get organized, all the fascists are bound to lose. But first, the headlines with Andrew Calloway.
It is from the State Attorney General's office interviewed Governor Cuomo for the first time on Saturday as part of the office's inquiry into alleged sexual harassment by the governor. A scandal-plagued Cuomo raised $2.2 million over the first 6 months of the year, giving him over $18 million in cash on hand as he heads towards a re-election campaign next year. The state's COVID-19 death toll is 11,000 fewer than the federal count. In his first appearance with Governor Cuomo since winning the mayoral primary, Eric Adams attacked New York's bail reform laws. With the good cause eviction bill currently stalled in Albany, tenant activists are focused on local versions of the law that could pass in several upstate New York cities. Mayor de Blasio is pushing the MTA to speed up implementation of congestion pricing, which was originally passed in 2019, but has been held up since then. Senator Chuck Schumer announced his opposition to the proposed fracked gas power plant in Astoria. With COVID rates in New York increasing for the first time since vaccine eligibility was opened up, city summer schools have already had to quarantine 80 classrooms. And in election news, Super PAC spent over $36 million on city primaries this cycle, up more than 50% from 2013, the last time there was an open mayoral race at the top of the ticket. Elizabeth Crowley conceded to incumbent Donovan Richards in the race for Queens Borough president, in a race that was nearly close enough to trigger an automatic manual recount. The most recent vote tallies for the mayoral race show that Adams won by less than a percentage point. The Bronx Democratic Party won every city council race it endorsed in, but a piece in The City suggests that the party apparatus has moved definitively to the left in response to congressional victories by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman. Governor Cuomo signed a bill to make it easier to request an absentee ballot in future elections. In interviews since his primary victory, Alvin Bragg, the Democratic nominee for Manhattan DA, has reaffirmed his progressive campaign messaging, saying that he disagrees with Eric Adams' statements on policing.
Thank you, Andrew. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA's Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So as I just said, today's show, we're going to be hearing from organizers from DSA chapters all over the country who came together for an introductory call hosted by our new National Anti-Fascist Working Group. So throughout tonight's show, we'll be hearing stories and anecdotes that they shared during that call. One thing I've learned as an organizer is that definitions of fascism can often be a sticking point for discussions of anti-fascist organizing. Fascism is a loaded word that brings up different associations for different people, and a lot of it truly is about the discussion and the discourse that you have about the definition of the word. But agreeing on some basic definitions of fascism and the far right can go a long way in helping us combat it. So to start tonight's show, let's hear what the organizers of last week's National DSA Anti-Fascist Call had to say on this question.
We are the official and NPC-recognized Democratic Socialists of America National Anti-Fascist Working Group, or the DSA-AFWG. We are the main conduit for fighting the far right in the DSA at a national and local level. Fascism exists as a specific political tendency that needs to be countered, while the far right is a broader political layer that intersects with many of the DSA's existing working groups and campaigns. The DSA-AFWG seeks to work in coalition with existing groups in DSA, a Specialist and Socialist of Color Caucus, an immigrant rights working group, to fight the far right in their attempt to brutalize BIPOC communities. The recent surge of anti-Asian, anti-trans, and misogynist anti-choice violence is another area of organizing for anti-fascist work within the DSA. So, what is fascism? Fascism could be an overly complicated term. Without deciding the term for all time tonight, fascism would best be understood as a revolutionary, right-wing, populist, ultra-nationalist political movement. Fascism is revolutionary, not Marxist way of changing ownership of the means of production. It seeks to eliminate perceived enemies through ultra-violent revolutionary methods, including ethnic cleansing and extermination. Fascism is populist in that it is a widespread popular movement pulling in peoples across class boundaries that seeks to upend the status quo. Fascism is ultra-nationalist in that it has the nation, ethnic or racial group, as the ultimate center and meaning for its political movements. Many political movements since 1945 had some, not all, of these qualities.
The far right and fascism terms that are frequently used interchangeably by people on the left. Political ideologies and movements are not things that can be permanently defined and empirically measured. Those of us who are active in it know that socialism is a complex collection of people who share some basic views but follow different paths on various issues. It's probably not hard to differentiate between people who are socialists and people who are fascists, but within those broad movements, people do not fit neatly into boxes. There have been many efforts to define fascism, but there's never been a broad consensus on it in any detail, and it seems unlikely that there will be. The historical antecedents of governments and movements embrace the term. However, none of those exactly match up with what is happening in the 21st century. However, there are common positions and approaches that link fascist movements over time. The word has a potent popular meaning, and there's seems to be little to be gained by attempts to divide the far right into real fascists and non-fascists. There are common beliefs that link these movements over time. White supremacy is one of the most basic. They cling tenaciously. The white people are inherently superior to all other people on the planet and are divinely entitled to rule over it. The most extreme version of this is white nationalism, which advocates for a racial separation of people in different parts of the country. White supremacy also translates in support of racially biased criminal justice system and seeks control over immigration. Christian theocracy advocates for a legal system that enforces traditional religious beliefs and practice. One of the most vigorous aspects of this movement is the determination to criminalize all forms of abortion and to greatly restrict access to medically safe forms of contraception. These views are pervasive in conservative religious groups. What distinguishes theocrats is the effort to roll back the clock to the point when they control American society. Tied to this is an ongoing war on the rights of people under the LGBT umbrella. The underlying cultural dynamic is this obsession to enforce the traditional prerogatives of straight white men. There's a loose collection of paramilitary organizations that are often referred to as the Patriot Movement. It typically embraces a collection of conspiracy theories claiming that the government and its institutions have been subverted by evil forces, depriving decent white people of their just rights. The list of evil forces has shifted over the years to include Jews, communists, etc. Present media attention focuses on the QAnon cult. We can trace these three broad trends back through most of the history of the United States. At any given time, there are various organizations that are contributing to the efforts to hold on to the power and control that legitimately belongs to the people who rightfully own the nation. The organizations and individuals disappear, while people who do not want to face the perniciousness of the movements attempted to claim that such disappearances represent the elimination of the threat, it does not go away. It just changes slogans and buzzwords. This year's favorite demon is critical race theory.
So you can't talk about fascism in North America without talking about the earliest instance, which is settlers arriving from Europe to colonize these lands and the indigenous people here. This genocide and forced assimilation is still happening as the U.S. government continuously breaks treaties and denies indigenous people resources. An example of the effects of this is the disparity in COVID deaths and cases between indigenous and settler populations. And allowing indigenous people to die of this virus because their existence threatens your power is fascism. It is important to note also that many white supremacist groups set up their centralized locations near Indian reservations and areas with large indigenous populations, as they want to continue the project of settler colonialism until there are no indigenous people left. Our indigenous comrades are some of the biggest targets of fascist attacks, but also the people who have been fighting back against these attacks the longest. So we must always stand in solidarity with them, listen and learn from their wisdom and experience. Anti-fascism that does not center this history and truth will end up being another version of settler colonialism.
You just heard the organizers of last week's National DSA Anti-Fascist Call on Definitions of Fascism in Revolutions Per Minute's special hour of anti-fascist story and song. The organizers highlighted several timely issues, such as the current Christian theocratic attack on abortion rights and queer and trans liberation, white supremacist and white nationalist ideas that are woven into the fabric of the United States, the recent rise of conspiracies and moral panics like those around QAnon and critical race theory, the far right's effort for control over immigration and borders, and the original sin of our country, settler colonialism, and the attempt at indigenous genocide. It's easy to spend a lot of time arguing about what is and is not fascism and lose sight of the material reality that various forms of far-right organization are threatening our lives, health, safety, and sanity on a daily basis. And one important first step to building anti-fascist organizing power and solidarity is understanding the conditions you're organizing in. So as we continue through tonight's show, we'll go now to our comrades on Long Island, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, and Houston to hear about the issues they see on the ground where they are.
Brooklyn has a long fascist history. It was formed in large part by white flight from New York City following the civil rights movement, creating and maintaining itself as the most segregated metropolitan area in the U.S. Currently, Long Island is home to over 70 police departments, and it's also where many NYPD officers lay their heads at night after a long day of brutalizing people in New York City.
Chicago definitely has a very long history of far-right activities, from the CPD, Chicago Police Department, black sites, Coleman Square, that are built to detain and torture and give false confessions, the Marquette Park Klan rallies, and of course, all the way back to the horrible Red Summer of 1919. Left. Neighborhood, which is traditionally a stronghold of racist white ethnic groups in the last decade, has changed to more of a mixed neighborhood, representatives from Mexican, Han Chinese, but still sections are largely white. And this is obviously the developing Chicago and the America that they're so terrified of. So they've come crawling out of the woodwork, so to speak. Lincoln Park and Logan Square get littered with Proud Boy propaganda. Fascists in my neighborhood again patrol the streets looking for their own black neighbors to eat with baseball bats during the George Floyd uprising. They can be found in suburbs like Schaumburg and Jefferson Park, and also in the sign defiantly posted on a balcony a street over from where I live, decrying anti-American BLM terrorists. The most common thread we deal with Chicago through all these is, of course, the Chicago Police Department and their enablers in City Hall. Since we can expect no form of accountability, and their constant compilation to the police union clearly demonstrates that they have not, do not, and will not keep us safe.
So we're a medium-sized city here in the heartland. With Cori Bush pushing for mental health and anti-policing legislation to replace the role of police when it comes to responding to mental health crises in our sister city, we'll be pushing to implement those same legislative goals ahead of congressional approval.
Portland's problem with its supremacists and white nationalists dates to the beginning of the founding of the state, and things got particularly hot in the 1980s and 90s, but that's beyond the scope of this talk, because it was here before Portland DSA was active, and we're talking about DSA and anti-fascist organizing. But I do want to acknowledge the deep history of anti-fascist work that was here in our city before our chapter and our working group were formed. Instead, I want to cover what we've been doing as anti-fascist organizers in response to a resurgence of fascist activity here in recent years. Teen Patriot Prayer, a Vancouver, Washington-based alt-right group, started crossing the river into Portland to hold rallies. Portland is right at the north of the state. Vancouver, Washington is just across the river, so it's a matter of driving 15 minutes to get from Vancouver to Portland. Started to come into town to hold rallies. They attracted and encouraged more extremist fascist groups to join the rallies, including the Proud Boys, American Guard, the Three Percenters, and the Oath Keepers. At the end of May 2017, Jeremy Christian, who's known to have attended at least rallies that people had held in Portland at that point, killed two people and injured in a racist attack on the light rail train. And immediately after those murders, Patriot Prayer announced that they would be holding a rally in Portland the following week.
Houston anti-fascist struggle has its roots in anti-racist action, which continued through the aughts and then was really given new life after Ferguson. Comrades from a milieu of various revolutionary organizations came together and formed a charter of the IWW General Defense Committee in Houston. And then we began to organize educational work on campus, as well as agitating and working to organize class struggles centered around building tenant pattern to fight against slumlords and developers. And this continued and elevated in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, when many tenants' already unmet needs in housing worsened with rampant untreated black mold and dilapidated structures after the flooding.
There's a great bloody fight around this whole world tonight, from Caracas to Chicago on to Spain. Trump, he told the world around that he'd tear our movement down. But our unity will break those prison chains, chains, chains. Our unity will break those prison chains. I walked up on a mountain in
crumble. Good people, what are we waiting on? Good people, what are we waiting on? So I thank the young lords and the vets against the war, and the unions on strike, here's what we found. When the people on the streets, then the fascists meet defeat. And that's how we know we'll tear those fascists down, down, down. That's how we know we'll tear those fascists down. There's a great and bloody flight round this whole world tonight, and the thirst for justice pulses through our veins. Bosses tell the world around that they'll tear our wounded down, but our unity will break those prison chains, chains, chains. Our unity will break those prison chains. Our unity will break those prison chains, chains, chains. Our unity will break those prison chains.
I'm Amy Wilson. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we have a special episode on DSA members conducting anti-fascist organizing all over the country. You just heard from comrades in Long Island, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, and Houston on their understanding of the conditions for anti-fascist organizing in their cities. From Long Island, with its over 70 police departments, to Portland, Oregon, with its long history of both white nationalist and anti-racist activity, comrades identified issues like housing discrimination and redlining and the after effects of climate disasters as crucial areas of struggle for anti-fascists. And of course, as you'll know if you're a regular listener of Revolutions Per Minute or a comrade in the Democratic Socialists of America, eco-socialism and tenants' rights are areas in which we are proud to say DSA is participating in powerful organizing. This is just one of the many ways in which anti-fascist organizing works in harmony with other liberatory struggles in our big tent organization of DSA. And speaking of working in harmony, you also just heard a wonderful musical performance of Tear Those Fascists Down from our comrade Dan of Sing in Solidarity, New York City DSA's musical working group. We'll be hearing more from Dan later in the show. But first, inspired by Dan's sharing of his musical talent for this show, I'd love to share another piece of art. I've mentioned before on Revolutions Per Minute that I'm an artist. More specifically, I'm a poet. Anti-fascism is a grueling field of organizing because you constantly have to confront the reality of racist, misogynist, transphobic, and xenophobic violence. And as you just heard from the comrades around the country, to confront the fact that that violence is not abstract or far away, but present in your very neighborhood or direct local community. This, in addition to the looming threat of state repression that is unfortunately often applied to active anti-fascist organizers, means that we find it to be critically important to engage in self and community care. Anti-fascists love to host book fairs, musical gatherings, picnics, and other spaces where we can enjoy each other's company and stay connected to the long lineage of struggle that fuels us to keep fighting on. So in that spirit, I'd love to share a poem with you now by a poet named Muriel Rukeyser, who was a mid-century poet from New York City. She was a queer Jewish woman who throughout her life reported on and wrote poetry about left, anti-war, anti-fascist, and union struggles, most notably the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster of 1931 in Gauley Bridge, West Virginia, which was one of the worst industrial catastrophes in United States history, and which resulted in her book-length poem, Book of the Dead. So the poem that I'm about to read for you is called Poem, I Lived in the First Century of World Wars, and it was written late in Muriel Rukeyser's career in the year 1968. I lived in the first century of world wars. Most mornings I would be more or less insane. The newspapers would arrive with their careless stories. The news would pour out of various devices, interrupted by attempts to sell products to the unseen. I would call my friends on other devices. They would be more or less mad for similar reasons. Slowly I would get to pen and paper, make my poems for others unseen and unborn. In the day, I would be reminded of those men and women brave, setting up signals across vast distances, considering a nameless way of living, of almost unimagined values. As the lights darkened, as the lights of night brightened, we would try to imagine them, try to find each other, to construct peace, to make love, to reconcile waking with sleeping, ourselves with each other, ourselves with ourselves. We would try, by any means, to reach the limits of ourselves, to reach beyond ourselves, to let go the means, to wake. I lived in the first century of these wars. That was a poem by Muriel Rukeyser. And you may not be surprised to learn that WBAI, as is so often the case when it comes to liberatory movements in New York City, has a connection to Muriel Rukeyser. On the day the Vietnam War ended, she came into the station to read one of her anti-war poems. This is the legacy of struggle and activism that we who live in the second century of world wars are trying both to preserve and to continue. But to do that, we need your help. It is vitally important to secure WBAI as a place where we can broadcast our own local struggles, as well as those we are in solidarity with nationally and internationally. We at Revolutions Per Minute dream of a WBAI that combines theory, practical organizing experience, community dialogue, art, and music into something that is truly special and representative of our diverse liberatory movements. You can be a part of making that station happen by supporting the station with a small donation every month. If you donate $25 or more in a calendar year, you're eligible to vote in station elections, which move WBAI closer to our goal of maintaining local control and a democratic approach. To give to the station, please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org. Thank you. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, the weekly radio show of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. Tonight, we're presenting a special hour of anti-fascist story, art, and song, much of which was recorded on July 11th at the National DSA Anti-Fascist Working Group introductory call. We've heard from comrades in Long Island, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, and Houston on their analysis of why anti-fascist organization was needed in their areas. Now let's hear what projects they've already taken on. And if you'd like to give us a call, please do so during this upcoming segment, and maybe we can have a chat on air. The number to call into the station is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. But while we wait for any callers to come in, let's go ahead and roll that clip.
As one of the first parts of our anti-fascist work, Suffolk County DSA put together a teach-in about fascism. So we touched on the not often talked about history of the German-American Bund nationwide, and locally on Long Island, the Nazi camp that was in Yaphank, Camp Siegfried. So this was the welcome sign that you would see if you entered Camp Siegfried. So this is in the early 1930s for context. Much of the history of fascism in the U.S. has been covered up, which is why we feel that political education is a necessary component of anti-fascist work. And the effects of the camp continued long after the camps and are a part of the racist housing history of Long Island. The surrounding housing developments had a discriminatory clause in their bylaws as recently as 2015 that required homeowners to be primarily of German extraction. And that has kept the community of 35 families there almost entirely white. So one of the central aspects of our chapter's anti-fascist work is solidarity and lending material support to our indigenous comrades' fight for liberation. New York State has waged a lawsuit against the Shinnecock Nation who built two monument signs to generate money to support their people. And despite the fact that these signs are built on Shinnecock land, Governor Cuomo and New York State are claiming the signs should not be there, forcing the nation to pay exorbitant legal fees. In November of 2020, Shinnecock Nation held a month-long protest called Sovereignty Camp 2020. And our chapter was able to support by being there physically, helping in the setup and breakdown of the camp, and donating supplies. And we will continue to support Shinnecock Nation, Uncotog Nation, and all the indigenous nations of so-called Long Island in their fight for liberation. And last, but not least, a big part of our anti-fascist work has been forming, growing, and maintaining mutual aid networks across Long Island. I won't be able to go into all the detail about the work these groups are doing, and this is also not an exhaustive list of the groups who are doing mutual aid in our area. Our chapter mutual aid working group has begun forming a Red Rabbits group in our chapter and our sister chapter in Nassau County. Norms and rules for protesting safely in the suburbs are different from in a city, because, as I mentioned earlier, you're dealing with over 7 police departments rather than just one or a few forces. And our last summer of suburban protests during the uprising showed a really big area for improvement in understanding our rights and keeping each other safe.
We were contacted then by Chicago for Abortion Rights to aid in a response. Immediately, we put out a call to other CDSA caucuses and working groups, including FEMSOC and our Redline branch, who was then able to contact the local IPO. So within 24 hours, we had arranged this pictured here with approximately 70 people in attendance outside of the Planned Parenthood. The following week, however, the Planned Parenthood was hit again with a rapid response. 4 hours later, we had arranged a night patrol of the area around at 11 p.m. where the person had been seen doing the evangelization. We were added by the Socialist Comrades from Loyola University and Food Not Bombs. The attacker has not returned, and while we cannot prove we were the deterrent, it proved the will to organize these rapid responses by working across various groups.
As a contributor to Food Not Bombs, I've seen countless citizens in the KC metro area give thanks, and some have even become helping hands when they see us handing out food to those who are struggling. We plan to organize more mutual aid centers around the city, and not only for food, but we've donated clothing and hygienic products as well. We hope to organize these same mutual aid drives with department co-ops, unions, and with other activist groups. Mutual aid takes us right now due to the increased gentrification in the city, which causes the minority populations to flee due to rising property taxes and other rising living costs.
People were scared and angry, and we recognized that we needed to mobilize the larger community to stand up to Patriot Prayer. Portland Stands United Against Hate formed as a coalition intended to mobilize the broader community beyond just the usual anti-fascist activists. Within a week, we formed a coalition led by ISO, which was still in existence then, Portland DSA, Unite Oregon, and VOS, which is an organization working in representing undocumented day laborers. So June 4th, 2017, we held a rally with over 70 political, activist, community, and religious groups and organizations all working in militia. We had a large turnout that greatly outnumbered the FASH across the street. We held our action directly on the street at City Hall. Then Rose City Antifa and other direct action groups were on the side of the FASH rally. And behind them, there was a small unionist counter-protest. So we had the Patriot Prayer rally close to 3 sides.
Given the amount of work that needed to be done on an almost cyclical basis, as you know, like about every like month and a half or so, they're coming to this town that like just requires a dedicated group of people to, you know, work on that response. So it made sense to create a working group just to do that. External organizer, co-chair, and myself tapped some folks that we thought would be interested and got to work on our group bylaws and our working group proposal. We endeavored to facilitate Portland DSA's involvement with local anti-fascist coalitions. But then the sizing of 2020 happened. And so even though this was not explicitly an anti-fascist, you know, movement, we did take kind of an expanded look at what our work could entail. Rather than just doing political education around fascism, we could also do tactical education around protests and direct action. So we began offering regular protest trainings to members in our chapter. We offered three specific ones, a protest 101 course, Safe in Our Streets, and Stop the Bleeding. The protest 101 course was an introductory but extensive training for what you might expect at a protest, what to bring and not to bring, your exit group, protective gear, you know, so on and so forth. We would pair this course with a Know Your Rights training, which was developed by a local DSA member who was also a member of National Lawyers Guild. We also had the Safe in Our Street training. And this was a very, very basic medic training. If you took it, it would not level of a street medic, but if you or one of your buddies got tear gassed, you'd be confident enough to get tear gas out of your eyes.
We began to develop a rapid response and security apparatus prior to the anarchist book fair in 2017, which was targeted by Patriot Front and the Houston Guerrillas, as well as some other Nazis. We successfully secured the building and made sure the events of the day continued uninterrupted. Comrades came together to defend all types of organizing events in Houston and began to understand the importance of militancy in our movement. We collaborate with comrades and organizations across Texas and nationally to secure book fairs, events, demonstrations, all from Nazi disruption. When our Muslim brothers and sisters were under attack from Nazis, we quickly and successfully organized a multi-day statewide mobilization of various DSA chapters and other local communist and socialist organizations to shut down racists.
Negras tormentas agitan los aires, nubes oscuras nos impiden ver. Nos espera el dolor y la muerte contra el enemigo, nos llama el deber. El bien más preciado es la libertad, hay que defenderla con fe y valor. Alza la bandera revolucionaria que del triunfo sin cesar nos lleve en voz. Alza la bandera revolucionaria sin cesar nos llevan pos. En pie el pueblo obrero a la batalla, hay que derrocar a la reacción. A las barricadas, por el triunfo de la confederación. A las barricadas, por el triunfo de la confederación.
You just heard comrades from Long Island, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, and Houston on anti-fascist organizing they've undertaken in their cities on tonight's Revolutions Per Minute special on anti-fascist organizing in DSA around the country. And once again, these stories were recorded on the National DSA Anti-Fascist Introductory Call on July 11th. Speaking of calls, we do have some time left in our show. So if you'd like to give us a call with a question or comment, please call 212-209-2877. Once again, that number is 212-209-2877. From supporting Indigenous struggles for self-determination to defending a local Planned Parenthood from vandalism, to performing mutual aid in concert with tenants groups and unions, to mobilizing counter demonstrations against far right and other racist hate groups, anti-fascists in DSA have taken on concrete projects and worked in coalition with groups outside of DSA to respond. And it's also true, as you heard from our comrade from Portland, Oregon, that the uprising of 2020 changed the landscape of anti-fascist and anti-racist organizing and dramatically upped the importance of resourcing our comrades on their legal rights as protesters in the face of rampant abuse by cops and learning how to keep each other safe in the streets. You also just heard a beautiful song performed by an anonymous comrade. The song is called A Las Barricadas, and it was a song sung by the Spanish anarchists in the Spanish Civil War. If you've been listening through the whole show, you'll remember the poem by Muriel Rukeyser. Incidentally, she herself was in Spain at the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War because she was covering the People's Olympiad, the Catalan government's alternative to the Nazis' 1936 Berlin Olympics, which is just a fun fact, especially as we approach our next Olympics season here in 2021. Just as with any organizing, anti-fascists should always take time to debrief and decompress from actions to determine lessons learned and what should be adjusted going forward. We'll finish tonight's show with some reflections from these comrades across the United States on what they've learned from their organizing so far. Let's go ahead and roll that clip.
As a smaller chapter and in a suburban area, members and leaders share a lot of responsibilities across many committees and working groups within our chapter, but we do feel that our mutual aid work lends itself quite easily to some of our anti-fascist work.
Now that people know we exist as a working group, we've become a pool of attraction for reports of far-right racist activity in various parts of the city. Within CDSA, we have reached out to our protest marshal team, the Red Rabbits, in coordinating rapid response with these reports and also to coordinate on different other projects that we can sort of aid each other with these responses to fascist violence. Other strategies we are employing include a forceful visual statement through agitprop and organized removal of areas that are littered with fascist propaganda to replace with our own. There is nothing fascists really hate more than the other. So this agitprop is intended to isolate and demoralize, which is sort of what they look to do themselves. The fascists on patrol is a replacement sticker for our friend, the Fraternal Order of Police, which is conveniently convertible to our real friend, fascists on patrol.
Tenants' push for social housing has brought immense changes to the metro area, including expansion fund and land bank initiative to help quell the issue of homelessness in our fair city. To stand with our brothers and sisters in solidarity is a must. The social movements here are gaining strength, and the campaigns will require protection from fascists the more attention they garner. For assisting this thing provide local government authority as the city develops. Plus, when the tenants, workers, and farmers mobilize into co-ops and unions, we must present ourselves as a staunch ally to our own community.
What we did learn was that a united front is more effective and safer for everyone. It's better to plan and work in coalition across tendencies and set up green, yellow, and red or hot zones so that participants can choose their own risk and flow back and forth as the day and their mood develops. When you're counter-protesting the fash, your biggest threats are still going to be the cops. So plan accordingly and keep each other safe. We employed whimsy and a sense of play that was in keeping with Portland culture, and it made it more inviting and less intimidating to average folks who wanted to stand up in some way but didn't feel safe on the front lines.
We should not let far-right demonstrations fly under the radar, particularly since they will be attracted to demonstrate in areas with a high concentration of leftist activity. And our current situation, they actually have not come back to Portland since that last event. During the election, those groups kind of turned their focus to the state capitol over in Salem. And then since the election, they've largely been focused on state events in more rural and suburban areas to shore up support. So those kind of those more safe areas where they won't anticipate having as much of a backlash. They aren't gone, that's important to note, and they will reemerge again if and when they feel strong enough to do so. But for right now, Portland has had some respite, and it'll be interesting to see what the rest of the summer brings.
We continue to track and disrupt multiple Nazi organizations, including Patriot Front, often Texas Patriot Network, Proud Boys, Lives Matter, and many others. Something critical to this work, which will be important for any meaningful contribution DSA can bring to the fight against fascism, is understanding that there are already many covert organizations doing this work. And if we don't want to alienate ourselves from a unified struggle against fascism, we must work from an understanding of the important principles of information distribution. So successfully working together to combat street and organized fascism involves making sure that the communities are aware of the threats, without also undermining the secrecy or element of surprise of any upcoming actions or infiltrative operations. And this element of collaboration, coordination, is particularly critical because fascists will pop up in different cities, They'll move, they'll change their jobs, they'll change which organizations they're affiliated with, and also change their pseudonyms. So we have to stay vigilant and work together. We want to make sure that DSA doesn't stray too far from operating within that mutual trust and confidence.
Now I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you might be surprised. People around this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose. There's people of every color marching side by side, marching down these streets. Their mouths are open wide, shouting, you lose, you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. You bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose. You can't stop DSA, we're 100,000 strong. Immigrants and workers will flush you down the john. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
That was members of DSA's National Anti-Fascist Working Group from Long Island, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, and Houston DSA chapters on what they've learned from their anti-fascist organizing projects as we come to the end of our special episode of Revolutions Per Minute. The comrades discussed the importance of keeping safe from the cops and remembering the cops are never allies in the struggle against fascism. They discussed working together in coalition with other groups, both covert and overt, to build relationships of mutual trust. And finally, they discussed the importance of building stable structures for anti-fascist response so that each time a rapid response is necessary, you don't have to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch every time. As with any anti-fascist organizing or any socialist organizing for that matter, this work is always undertaken collectively. And the benefit of doing it within an organization like DSA is that it's easy to draw connections between other campaigns, as in mutual aid, tenant organizing, eco-socialist, or abortion access organizing that may also be housed within DSA. We are a socialist organization, and we call ourselves a big tent organization, which means that not only can multiple political tendencies like communists and anarchists exist in harmony, but also that we have a variety of issue campaigns on topics that are important, we believe, to the liberation of the overall working class. You also just heard our last song of the night, beautifully performed by Dan Wyman of New York City DSA's Music Working Group, Sing in Solidarity. And you may have caught that Dan cleverly altered the lyrics of that classic song to include a shout out to DSA and our journey toward being 100,000 members strong. So we send our thanks to Dan, as well as to our anonymous musical comrade who performed A Las Barricadas earlier in the show. We also thank Sareen Patel, who composed the instrumental music you've heard throughout tonight's episode, and our comrade Rob, who assisted with the audio production for this show. As we come to the end of tonight's show, I personally want to reiterate the importance of anti-fascist organization, something that I feel very strongly. Regular listeners of Revolutions Per Minute have heard me on this topic many times before by now. There are many forms of anti-fascist activism, some of which we've covered on tonight's show and some of which we haven't, but what they have in common is a commitment to collective action.
It's very easy to feel helpless in the face of a rising tide of far-right and nationalist movements around the globe. But our best weapon against this is always our solidarity. And that's a hallmark of organizing in a big tent organization like the Democratic Socialists of America. Do not let the right's scare tactic about quote-unquote Antifa being dangerous or indiscriminately violent take hold. What is dangerous to all of us in the working class is the unchecked rise of the far right, and it will take all of us to hold this tide back so we can build the better world we know is possible. This concludes tonight's broadcast. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Thank you so much for joining us for our special episode of Revolutions Per Minute. I'm Amy Wilson, and I will see you next week. Until then, solidarity from New York City.
Hi, this is Doug Wood from Green Street, heard every Tuesday morning here on WBAI. At most radio stations, the focus is on advertising, ratings, and profits. Here at WBAI, the focus is on people and issues. We don't have advertisers, and while that provides us with editorial freedom, it also means we depend on your financial support to stay on the air. Please join Patty and me by becoming a member of WBAI, ensuring this station's future and your 24/7 access to the truth. It's easy and quick. Just visit WBAI.org. And thank you.
Extinction Diaries. The Gobi Bear is the only bear in the world that lives exclusively in a desert. The Gobi is also the world's rarest bear and critically endangered. There are less than 40 in the wild and none known to exist in captivity. The Mongolian government is dedicating funds and territory protection to stop the extinction in one of the world's most inhospitable environments. Giant sand dunes, ice canyons, raging wind, cold and heat are all characteristics of the Gobi Bear's home, and it is human activity again driving the race to extinction. International mining operations are polluting the desert while extracting coal, copper, and gold from the region. And seasonal grasslands, vital to all wildlife, is being destroyed by overgrazing domesticated livestock. Gobi bears travel great distances from oasis to oasis, and because humans, including poachers and illegal miners, depend on the same oasis water supplies, the outcome for the bears is often tragic. In 2014, the Gobi's numbers fell to under 30 and have since risen. There is hope. They need more love. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
And RPM goes into sudden death overtime.
Yes, no penalty kick. So I do understand we've got some calls on the line, and I thought we could hear what these folks have to say. Do we have anybody on the line with us now?
Oh, maybe they hung up. We'll try the other one. Anyone hanging on that line?
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to disenfranchise you. That goes against my anti-fascist values.
Caller, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, you're on live.
Interesting program. 2 points. Mm-hmm. The song you played that you mentioned was from the Spanish Civil War. Actually, mm-hmm. goes about 60 or 70 years earlier. It's called Nowa Sowa. It's the Polish socialist workers' song of the middle 1850s, if you will.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And they repurposed it with different lyrics.
Of horror perpetuated on working people. Question: do we ever talk about, in socialist circles or, you know, democratic social circles, the revolutions of 1848 in Europe? Because I can say it's an American tradition. If you look at the Civil War in the United States, a whole section of the men wearing the uniform of the blue, the good guys, were men who had fought in the uprisings of 1848 and were the original socialists. Men like Carl Schurz, who was a Republican senator from New York State, Alexander Schimmelpfennig, Franz Sigel, they were all generals in the Federal Army, and they were, guess what? They were socialists. They were abolitionists, and they also were horrified about the treatment of the Native people in America. They were heroes. There were thousands of them in the Federal Army. Is there any attempt to bring this to light? Because, of course, it's not in our history books, needless to say.
Right, of course. Yeah, and I can tell that you're a history buff, both with your factoid there about Alas Barricadas, which is totally right.
I never heard anything about this until a book I began reading. Yeah, this is unbelievable.
Yes, absolutely. No, it is really interesting, and I do think that is a lot of the project of democratic socialism in general in the 21st century, is reclaiming this history that's been lost. I don't hear people talking too much about 1848. What I have heard people talking about more, and my comrade who hosts the show on alternate nights, Jack Devine, is a specialist in this, is talking about Reconstruction and the ways in which the moment that we have in the 21st century now really has a lot of potential parallels to the moment of Reconstruction, lessons that we could learn about the sort of failed liberatory project of Reconstruction itself, but not so much about, 20 years earlier. So you raise a really good point there, caller.
Well, real quick, let's go to 1964. All the signs, all the materials paid for by Martin Luther King's March on Washington, I Have a Dream, these were paid for by the United Auto Workers, a guy named Walter Reuther, the grandson of socialists from the Ruhr area of Germany, the original socialists, if you will. All throughout the Midwest, you have chapters of people in the unions who were part of that struggle from various parts of Europe. And I can say this much. My great-great-grandparents were born as serfs in Slovakia, which is in Austro-Hungary. I just found this out as a history buff. My great-grandparents were no longer serfs because of the revolution of 1848. It's astounding.
Oh, interesting. So there's a personal connection. I mean, Walter Reuther is a little bit of a tricky figure in unionist history because, unfortunately, he did go on to have some pretty anti-communist views in the labor movement.
Okay.
But it just goes to show you, I think you make a beautiful point about the ways in which, things are passed on through generations, and our struggles are not only connected sort of horizontally, if you will, but also through time. And I think you raise a really good point that if we looked back at the struggles of the past, we would certainly learn valuable lessons about how to move forward. And it's a very important part of the overall socialist project.
I continue with your terrific program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. And that concludes our Revolutions Per Minute special addendum. Thank you to our caller for contributing those wonderful thoughts. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, as always, to Max in the studio. We'll be back on live next Wednesday at 9 p.m. I'm Amy Wilson, signing off for Revolutions Per Minute once more.
Extinction Diaries. The Center for Biological Diversity is one of the most effective wildlife watchdogs on Earth. They are desperate to stop an extinction in progress of a little mouse that hibernates up to 9 months a year. The New Mexico meadow jumping mouse population in parts of the state are near zero, and the culprits are too visible. Ranchers have been caught illegally grazing hundreds of times on land protected for the meadow mouse. The U.S. Forest Service has failed to enforce the law or even give citations to lawbreakers. The center is demanding an investigation. 3 decades ago, the mouse was found in 17 streamside locations in southern New Mexico's Lincoln National Forest, and now they can be found in only one. In neighboring Arizona, environmental organizations had to sue the Forest Service to protect the meadow mouse in that state. The U.S. Forest Service mission statement reads as follows: to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
This is WBA.